welcome to Animal Voices. We're broadcasting live from Vancouver's co-op radio station, CFRO 102.7 FM for now, and soon to be 100.5 FM and on September 10th. Animal Voices is dedicated to bringing you the latest news, events, and interviews in the world of compassionate living and animal advocacy. Today is Friday, September 7th, 2012. I'm your host, Alyssa Ray. I'm joined in studio today by Allison Cole,
hello,
my lovely co-host, and Tim Aretz, our tech trainee. Thanks for joining us today, guys. On today's show, we're featuring two Canadian superstars, in my opinion, two women who use their talent and passion to get the word out about living vegan. Both guests today include children in their message, and that makes this a great show for families. First, we feature Vancouver's own cookbook queen, Drina Burton. She'll speak with us about her latest cookbook and tips on raising vegan children and about what food activism means to her. On the second half of today's show, we'll share a conversation I had with Joanne MacArthur of We Animals. Over the last 12 years, Joanne's been traveling all over the world as a photojournalist, pulling back the curtains and documenting all kinds of animal use and abuse. Through her lens, you can see the story of animals sort of more through their eyes. And I had a great conversation with her, so I'm excited to share that in the second half of the show. Let's see, let's get up to date. I haven't seen you in a while, Allison.
Yeah.
I heard that you attended a demonstration last week, was it?
Yeah, so as we were talking about on the show last week, it was Japan Dolphins Day last Friday, August 31st? A week ago it was. Wow, it's not August anymore. And Denise, our guest co-host, and I went down to the demo that was happening for Japan Dolphins Day at the Japanese Embassy on West Hastings Street here in Vancouver, because we wanted to support that event and help out. We got there after the show. It was an event that went from noon till 3, although we left at 3 and it was still going pretty strongly. Apparently, there were about 75 to 100 people there at the beginning, and when we got there, there was still a lot of people there showing their support for the dolphins. Basically, it's sort of the financial district in downtown, so there's just a lot of cars driving by. So the cars would see our signs and honk to support, which was great, really great. It makes me feel good when I know that other people, just sort of regular people who aren't so entrenched in the animal rights community, and that are supportive of a simple message such as save the dolphins, you know, don't kill the dolphins, don't slaughter the dolphins. Of course, the opening of the Japanese Taiji slaughter started last Saturday, which is why Japan Dolphins Day has been proclaimed for the day before. On August 31st, it was an event that was happening in 94 cities all around the world.
Wow.
So there was also a local singer there, Carol Cox. She was singing some beautiful songs for the animals there, and a song that we actually played at the end of the show last week called Angel of the Sea that she composed, and it's specifically for the dolphins. So good event, and I just hope that I don't know if any media was actually there, because I think those events really are dependent for their success for media attention, because it's all good and fine if you're there, you know, protesting the people that, well, not protesting too, but demonstrating in front of the people that drive by. I hope the Japanese embassy knew we were there. I'm sure they didn't see them. But it really makes more of a difference if the whole city knows about it via the news and that. So
yeah, generally it seems like in Vancouver there's pretty good coverage of events like that. I know, which one is it, the 24 Hours or Metro, one of those daily papers,
they've got a lot of support,
covers
there
quite a I bit know of those demonstrations.
I think
and
they're
I'm impressed.
Plugged in for sure. Yeah,
that's great. And what have I been up to?
It was your birthday. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. I was born. I survived another year. Hurrah. I went for a little getaway with Tim and another friend of mine named Shan, and we went to Saturna Island, which is a beautiful island, beautiful golf island, sort of near Main Island, I guess.
It takes
a while to get there. It's really small. It's only 350 people live there year round. There was so much wildlife. It's such a quiet place. There's no running water or, you know, toilets or anything. So it's just an outhouse.
I think that's
it's
fantastic
a really low-key
place. Yeah, it's a small island, right? And yet it's just, as you were mentioning on Facebook, it seems to be overrun by wildlife and animals. It's like the animal island.
It seems like there's a really good sort of harmony there. There's tons of deer. They have no natural predators there, and they seem to feel really safe around humans.
Right.
So we had lots of encounters with deer. I saw a mama raccoon and her three little puffball baby cubs turning over rocks at low tide. That was really touching. I saw some wild roaming turkeys, which was really surprising.
I've only seen wild turkeys in Australia. I didn't even know we had them around these parts.
I don't think they're native to the island.
How did they get there?
They've either escaped or someone's going to shoot them one day.
Do they look like farmed turkeys?
They look like sort of beautiful heritage breeds, like really, you know, they're not white. They have really long brown feathers, and they were really pretty, and they're just very curious about us, and just kind of along the side of the road in the forest, just kind of slowly walking around, and that was really, really, really amazing. And of course, eagles and just lots of awesome things. There was one, speaking of deers and leading into what I'm going to say next, there was a sign at the park that we were camping at that Tim noticed that said that just to beware, there's natural resource harvesting going on from the Aboriginal group who lives there, including deer hunting. And I don't know about you, but anytime I hear about animals being harvested, I get a little bit disturbed. Mm-hmm. It's like they're just picking them when they're ripe and juicy. And
I think it's a euphemism for brutally murdered and slaughtered.
And of course, they have families, and these are moms and children, and I don't know. Anyway, so speaking of hunting, I heard yesterday that our local TV station, Global News, is canceling all of their hunting shows from as of next year. There's three of them. One of them has been running for 8 years. It's called Canada in the Rough, and it's Canada's most popular hunting show. I went to their website. It's, of course, I just burst out in tears. It's just really, really sad seeing all these people really proudly posing by these
beautiful dead creatures. You wonder where these people are coming from.
Yeah,
understand a mindset
They say on their website, they said, "Our hunting heritage is under constant attack by those who have forgotten that hunting is at the root of human existence and still the most valuable and effective tool in wildlife management." So there's a little window into what they are thinking and how they justify what they're doing. But, I'm really excited that Global will no longer be showing these shows. According to an Ipsos Reid public opinion poll 2 years ago, 62% of Canadians say that hunting for sport amounts to cruelty to animals. Only 62. In BC, only 2% of people engage in hunting, and 5% in the rest of Canada. So it is a very small amount of people who actually do this. So that was just notable news for me. And let's talk about Animal Voices news. What's coming up for us?
We have our end of summer potluck this Sunday. I'm looking forward to it. I'm getting the details arranged this week, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. The weather is going to hold up. This is actually, I think, probably going to be our last sunny weekend that's what I'm predicting for our summer in Vancouver. So we're having an end of summer potluck joining up with Robbie C. this Sunday, September the 9th, starting at 5:30 p.m. Your Animal Voices hosts will be there, and we'll be enjoying lots of vegan food, and I encourage everyone to come. Everyone is welcome. We just ask that you bring a vegan dish to feed 8 people if you can, and bring your own cutlery and your own plates and that. And we're going to have a raffle there with lots of great prizes. And we're going to be meeting at the covered picnic area, which is on the south end of the lake near the concessions and that. And And so if people want to meet there, they're seating for about 50 people, but we
already... less to me.
Yeah, they said 50. Maybe 50 if you squish in.
Yeah, bring a blanket, bring some chairs if you want to be comfy.
I'm going to bring a chair, yeah. So I think it's going to be great, yeah. And I'm just looking forward to actually spending, because I don't feel like I really had a summer here in Vancouver, just to spending one last hurrah in Vancouver for the summer and enjoying it. And then it's going to start raining the next day. No, kidding.
Yeah.
But we sort of knew when we were planning this that it's this is basically, I think, the last weekend we could do it, and it was the only time we could really do it. So yay! So come to our potluck. It's going to be fun. Trout Lake, 5:30 p.m. Info is on our website, animalvoices.org, if you want to check it out there. And please do check that out.
Awesome. Yay. I'm excited. On the news of healthy, wholesome, vegan food, we have our first interview coming up. Drina Burton is a cookbook author and stay-at-home mama in Vancouver, Canada. Her past books, The Everyday Vegan, Vive la Vegan, and Eat, Drink, and Be Vegan, have helped thousands transition and nourish their families and loved ones. In addition, she's won several blog awards, including the Veg News Veg Bloggy Award and Vancouver's Ultimate Mom Blog. I spoke with Drina Burton last week about vegan parenting and about her newest book, Let Them Eat Vegan, 200 delicious plant-powered recipes for the whole family. I wanted to first offer you congratulations on the new book. You've been cooking vegan for over 20 years, and this is your fourth vegan cookbook. And in my opinion, it's really fabulous, very thorough, and incredibly user-friendly. Can you tell us about this new book and what makes it special? What makes it stand out?
Sure. Thank you. I mean, I've always cooked with whole foods through all of my cookbooks. I've utilized what I always call the vegan basics, because when I became vegan, there weren't a lot of the substitutes out there. I mean, we're kind of spoiled now. There's all kinds of fun products for us to play with and use as substitutes. But when I became vegan, that just wasn't available. The only thing I had as a substitute was really some non-dairy milks, and that was very limited, mostly soy milk. So I always worked with those as the basics. And over the years, I think I've sort of evolved and come into learning about more and more with whole foods and using whole grain flours. And so while I've always used whole ingredients in my books, in my other books, say in the dessert sections, I would use white flour for cakes. And now with this book, everything is whole foods based. There's no white flour. There's no heavily processed ingredients. Things are really what I call, again, the vegan basics of using nuts and grains and seeds and beans and whole grain products, and just combining them in really fun ways to make the best of what we have, which is like so many delicious, wonderful ingredients to begin with. But when we can combine them in different ways, it can be really creative and fun. And so that's the main premise of the book, is that it's whole foods and not with processed substitutes, and also all the recipes are either wheat-free or gluten-free.
Wow, that's awesome. The recipe titles and everything are all very impressive, and everything seems like it has very rounded flavors. I'm really excited to try a lot from it. It doesn't just look like your basic kind of health food cookbook. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, well, I mean, I think sometimes people feel that when we are utilizing the whole foods, that it can be light fare, you know, like I think people connect that to being like a lot of salads or just kind of really light fare, which is good. We should eat those things. But I also have a family that, you know, wants some hearty meals. So I like to put things together like nuts in combination with grains or grains in combination with beans to make really hearty dishes, so that either being nut burgers or casseroles or really hearty soups or whatever it might be, but that it really satisfies. And so, yeah, thank you. I think that's, you know, that's my goal, is to make it look approachable, but also really delicious and satisfying.
Yeah, awesome. So speaking of approachable, I noticed that you have a whole bunch of kind of ways to sort of alter the recipes or suggestions for making them kid-friendly or adult-minded or substituting things. I really appreciate all the user-friendly tips. It feels like you're a professional right in the kitchen beside me. Is it hard to, you know, consider all your readers' needs? It seems like you have a really wide appeal. Like, when you're making your recipes, you have to have so much in mind. Is that a big challenge for you?
It's a challenge for me not to consider all of them, because I want people to be able to enjoy the recipe, and I know that there are so many either children with allergies or parents themselves with certain food intolerances and things like that. So I'm always mindful of, if I make a recipe with cashews, that maybe can I find a way to substitute the cashews with something else so that people who have nut allergies can't eat it, or if I make something with wheat, then can I substitute it so that it can be gluten-free? So I'm often, my mind is kind of riddled with, can I make it accessible? So at some point I have to cut myself off and say, okay, you can't please everyone, but I do try to do my best to give people some substitutions, and also just to make it easier to cook, because you may not have something on hand. You may not have pumpkin seeds, so can you use something else? So I also like to give people those options just for ease in the kitchen, and that we mightn't always have, you know, the perfect stock pantry or whatever. But yeah, I like to try to at least hopefully give readers the feel that I'm walking them through the recipe, because there are a lot of people just getting started, and if this is one of their first vegan cookbooks, then they might feel a little bit intimidated with whatever particular recipe or cooking in general. So yeah, I like to try to give them lots of tips.
Yeah, the tips are there, and also your really grounded, kind of funny, and really personal approach. I think that will really work to help people through it as well, is that you're just a human, and you have lots of funny stories about feeding your family and stuff. So that's definitely appreciated as well. Did you, I haven't actually read all of your previous cookbooks. Is that something you've always kind of done, is like the personal stories?
Yeah, I have. I think more and more, I did actually, though, right from the beginning, I would give tips, like in The Everyday Vegan, that was my first book, and I'd give tips in the sidebar. But I think more and more, because I would hear from my readers, and they say they like that. Like, they always would say, it feels like you're there in the kitchen with me. I really like that. So I've expanded on it, and I think with this book, I have given more than ever. And I kind of said to my publisher, like, oh my gosh, you're going to want to, like, you know, scream at me after you try to format this with all of these tips. But they were really cool about finding a way to get them in there, and I was happy about that. And you know, what you said about just sort of being a regular person, and that's true. I mean, I think sometimes people feel that vegans, must live particularly special. And I'm, you know, a mom with three kids and do what most moms do, trying to get through activities and busy schedules every day with kids. So we've been living this way for a long time, and it's very doable.
As you said, I'm not sure if our listeners know, but yes, you are a family woman. You have a husband and three daughters, and this book is definitely made with families in mind. While you have impressive-sounding meals like tempeh and lemon thyme and caper sauce and fettuccine with chanterelle breadcrumbs, you also include lots of suggestions for making the recipes kid-friendly or adult-minded. Can you talk about that kind of balance there to kind of please young tongues and older people?
Sure. Well, you know, kids in general will have their preferences. We have three girls, and each of them likes certain things a little bit differently. Some like certain foods and the others don't. And whenever I'm doing a recipe, though, in general, my kids, and, you know, it's different for all parents, but in general, my kids will not like spices that they can bite into, like cumin seeds or mustard seeds. They do not like pieces of onions or pieces of peppers. So there's certain things that kids really will detect in recipes. And I like to give people the option that if they're creating something, that they can sometimes modify it, and such that they can remove a bit of the batch for themselves or for their kids, and then add some spice in after for them. Or like with the fettuccine that you mentioned, that's actually a pretty kid-friendly recipe. But when I'm in the general recipe, I say that you can reduce the wine used in the recipe, because kids will, you know, pick up on that flavor even though the alcohol burns off through the cooking. And also with the chanterelle breadcrumb topping, Children mightn't like that, but that's something that's a little more sophisticated that if you are having guests, you might want to do that. So, through the book I try to say, you know, this recipe is pretty kid-friendly, but if you want to bump up the spices, if you want to kick it up a little bit and make it more interesting for adult palates when we like things like spice and, a real variety of different flavors and more pungent tastes, then you can do that. Or I have a recipe that's a little more adult-minded, and I say, you know what, your kids may not like this. If you're making it for them, you might want to remove this and then try it later. So it's all about trying to make a recipe flexible but not making different meals for your kids, because then that's a gong show. If you're making two different meals for yourselves and your kids, that's just too much work.
Yeah, no doubt. So speaking of, you know, more about pleasing kids and cooking for them, you do include chapters on powering the vegan family and plant-powered lunchbox, and even about making baby food. Can you share a bit of wisdom about vegan parenting tips?
Yeah, and on that note, my website is plantpoweredkitchen.com, and I've just started a series called the Plant Powered Kids Series, because even though I have these tips in my book, there's more topics that can be covered, obviously, with respect to raising children vegan, and just everything that goes into raising children and social aspects and school and food, and there's just so much. And I kind of polled my readers earlier in the summer to ask them if they'd like this addressed, you know, in the format of a blog, and it was a really enthusiastic response. So now I've started a series where I cover those topics in a little bit more detail. But yeah, in the book, I talk about those things, like starting from the beginning when you're making baby food, and then making lunches for your kids, because as we know, once your kids are into school, it's the school system pretty much is geared towards the standard way of eating, and there's not a lot of alternatives with hot lunches and things like that for your kids. So I talk about my experiences and how I've approached it to the ages that my kids are at right now, and my eldest is almost 12. I haven't hit teenage years yet, so I'm still in the learning phase of that. But I think that as parents, you know, we can all benefit from each other's experiences on those things, and that's why I started this series on my blog, too, to just kind of get other people's perspectives on what they're doing, too, and we can kind of learn from each other. But I think people go into parenting with, you know, in terms of veganism, and thinking it's going to be really, really hard. But generally, I have found that our kids have grown with it and have come to understand it on different levels as they get older. So it's not as hard as I thought it was going to be. And I try to communicate that to my readers, because I think when they are looking at it from a place of being pregnant or having a toddler, and they think way ahead, like, oh, wow, what happens when my kid's a teen and their friend wants to go to McDonald's? Or what happens when they go to a birthday party when they're 7 and there's only vegan food there? Well, all of that you work up to, and by the time your children are at those older ages, they really start to become attached and confident with the diet themselves. And so it's not about trying to manage it all yourself as a parent. At least that's my experience so far. And it seems more daunting than it is. I think, like, the whole notion of becoming vegan itself, I think people feel it's really difficult, but once they do it, they realize it's not as hard as they thought it would be. And I think that pertains to parenting with vegan children as well.
I see it as kind of like a doorway that, like, it really is a doorway, but some people think it's like leaping off, you know, into a void or something.
That's true, going into this great unknown, this big abyss, but that's an analogy.
One thing leads to another. That's really great wisdom. So I am curious to kind of to bring it back and know a bit more about the philosophy behind your plant-based lifestyle. I wondered if you could just share a bit about certain books that have influenced your path.
Oh, well, let's see. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, I read Diet for a New America, and that was a very pivotal book for me. I had also read Fit for Life, which isn't a vegan book, but it just made me think about my food choices and helped me learn more about dairy, in particular that book, and the acidic nature of eating animal products and what it does to our bodies and that kind of thing. So that book made me think more about food. But Diet for New America was one of the ones that really just sort of opened my eyes, and I had to really reconsider what I was doing. And it was just myself and my husband at the time, but and we weren't married then. We were just kind of, you know, dating and doing our thing. And after that, I started to just become immersed a little bit more in the vegan world. And there wasn't much online as there is now. There's so much that is available to people. But I also started to learn about Eric Marcus's work through vegan.com. And his books were also significant when I was learning about then the animal welfare side of being vegan. So those were the books, and they were early days, and now there's so much more out there for people to really learn from. But those were sort of big ones for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. Those are excellent works. And I know you do have on your website, plantpoweredkitchen.com, a whole list of resources for people who are interested. And I think that's important sort of backbone. People need that extra support. Just kind of finally, I just wondered if you considered your cooking like an outreach tool, and do you consider yourself a food activist?
Oh, it's interesting you ask that, because I've never considered myself an activist, because to me, activists are the people who are out there, like physically out there doing things. But I realized just recently, one of my friends said to me, she said, you know, you are an activist. And I sat back and I thought, I guess in a way I am. It's that my activism is through my online work and through what I share through my food and my recipes, and just even on Facebook and Twitter, the stories I share, the posts I share, all of that is a form of activism. I've just never really sort of defined myself in that way. But for sure, when you can show people that food is just as delicious, in fact, more delicious, eating vegan, and that it also supports your health, and it supports, you know, kindness through, you know, just everyday life, animals and the environment. It's just all-encompassing. And when you can show people that that starts with your plate every day, then I think, yeah, it is pretty much a form of food activism, like you say. And people love to talk about food. It's crazy, right? We like to take pictures of it, and we're blogging about it. And when I put up a post of a good-looking cake or a really good meal that we had, it's crazy the amount of comments that come in. So I think that those types of things really have a sharing effect. People like to talk about it, and social media is a great way to just spread that word. And so, yeah, people come to learn about it just through the food, and it tends to just bring awareness. I've had people who go to my Facebook page and then talk to me later in more depth about the implications of eating animal products, but they were brought to the page because of a picture of a cake, you know. So sometimes it really has more impact than we might think.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't agree more. And yes, I agree. You are a food activist. We all, you know, use our special skills and talents to do what we do best and speak out in that way. And so kudos to you for your activism and for your wonderful books and your excellent blog. I will post links on our website and everything to help people get in touch and learn more. And I wanted to thank you for your time today, Drina.
Thank you, Alyssa. I appreciate it.
That was Drina Burton, Vancouver-based cookbook author, talking about her latest book, Let Them Eat Vegan.
Tune in Thursday night.
100 delicious plant-powered recipes for the whole family.
Salad from 7 to 8 p.m.
Tune in to Fruit Salad. Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad.
Check out Fruit Salad Thursday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. on 102.7 FM, highlighting queer, trans, lesbian, gay organizations, writers, performers, musicians, families, pink world news, and much, much more. Fresh fruit every show.
Tune in and queer out.
You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. We are soon to be 100.5 FM starting in 3 days. So tune into our show next week at 100.5 FM. Co-op Radio is broadcasting from East Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territory in Canada. So Surrey is the next city in the crosshairs of activists who want to ban shark fin soup from all of Metro Vancouver's Chinese restaurants to reduce fishing pressure on threatened sharks. And we spoke about the shark fin issue last week, if you remember that. Can we get Alyssa's mic on, please? Hey, Alyssa.
Hey.
I don't know if you heard the show yet last week. We spoke a little bit about the shark fin issue last week because my main interviewee, it was Marley Daboduck, who's actually one of the main people who is spearheading the campaign in Vancouver to get rid of shark fin in the Metro Vancouver area. And if people remember, Anthony Marr, a local activist as well, was on our show a couple months ago to speak about the whole process that was starting in Metro Vancouver, trying to get Coquitlam, Port Moody, and North Vancouver, who are now have committed to ban shark fin sales in their cities. But what is really needed is to get a whole all-encompassing ban in Metro Vancouver. So next Monday, in Surrey, the Surrey Council will be having a presentation by the Vancouver Animal Defense League. Anthony Marr will be there. And that's on September the 10th. And then in Langley, in the city of Langley, on September the 17th. And then Maple Ridge's Council is expected to discuss this issue on September 11th ahead of a presentation at a later date. So I think this is fantastic. Activists have been focusing, as I've been saying, on Vancouver, Richmond, and Burnaby because that is the home to the most Chinese seafood restaurants that use shark fin. And Anthony believes that they are close to agreeing to having a whole coordinated ban to take effect within 6 months.
Yeah.
Really great news. I love how it's been snowballing and everyone's sort of leaping on. Richmond is not really on board yet, but I believe they will be once we can get all the surrounding communities. Mm-hmm. And as people have mentioned before in council meetings, that they're really, like, if you just ban it in Vancouver, they're just going to drive over to Richmond, right? So it really needs to be all-encompassing.
Yeah, and hopefully BC-wide. I think Anthony and team are also working on that as well.
Well, Anthony has asked all BC cities to support a shark fin ban resolution that is going to be voted on at the end of this month, actually. So that'll be voted on at the Union of BC's Municipalities Convention in Victoria, which will hopefully get all the cities to do it all at once. So I think this is fantastic.
Great.
And as I said, Richmond is opposing right now. And activists last month actually confronted one outlet demanding fin samples to test to determine if the fins came from endangered shark species, and the owner refused to cooperate. I know that was in the local news that made news headlines on TV. And actually Marley, who was on the show, she was the one who was featured in that news story. So activists do claim, and this is true, that 100 million sharks a year are dying for the fin trade, and perhaps a third of them may be endangered. So that's quite a concern. So just wanted to mention that event, the presentation is happening next Surrey at the Surrey Council, and that's happening at 4 p.m. There's going to be a rally at 3 p.m. at the Surrey City Hall. So if people want to show up for that and then stay for the meeting, that would be fantastic. I know that these presentations and the meetings have been having a lot of support from people who care about the sharks. And I'll mention one more event, Tuesday, September the 11th, next week at 8 p.m. I thought this was kind of cool. There's going to be a fashion show, which I haven't heard happening before, but apparently it's happening annually in cities across North America. It's called the Cool versus Cruel Fashion Show, happening at the Fortune Sound Club at 147 East Pender Street. And this is being put on in part by the Humane Society of the United States and the Art Institutes. And students will be showing and competing against students for a chance to advance to New York City on cruelty-free fashions. So that's next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
nation, born free and made a slave of vanity and indulgence. Born free and made a slave of apathy and indifference.
That was Canadian musician Kip Harness with his song Ghosts in Our Machine, and that leads into our next interview. Jane Goodall said, "Only if we understand can we care. Only if we care can we help." There's one person I know of who is dedicated her life to helping people understand the plight of non-human animals. That's Joanne MacArthur. She's a globe-trotting photojournalist whose project, We Animals, spans over 40 countries, and over 80 animal aid organizations have benefited from donations of her work. She is a deeply empathetic person, and she uses her camera lens to focus on the animals and to help viewers see through their eyes. She doesn't just take pictures, she uses her art to give back to the community. Joanne MacArthur, based in Toronto, is the recipient of the 2011 Canadian Empathy Award in the arts category and was recognized by CBC as one of 50 top champions of change in Canada. So, first of all, thank you for joining us on Animal Voices today, Joanne.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So let's talk first about your life's project, We Animals. Tell us about the aim and the scope of that project.
Okay, well, I conceived of the We Animals project at least a dozen years ago, and it's something that I started shooting close to home. What I wanted to do was just look at our relationships with animals and photograph the things that we often don't notice. You know, we're so used to seeing meat markets, and we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals and our exploitation of animals. So I started shooting close to home, and I'm also a traveler, so it kind of expanded from there. I'd go to other countries, and instead of just going to have a good time, I'd photograph animal issues, and then eventually that became what all of my travel was about, going abroad to volunteer and to document stories and compile all of these stories into the We Animals project.
Well, I'm kind of curious, like, did you come to animal issues first and then photography as kind of a method to get the message out there, or was it the other way around?
I was always into photography, and I wanted to be a photographer, and after a few years of doing it, I realized that I could combine my passions for helping animals and my passion for photography, and there was a unique thing there. You know, I could help animals through taking great pictures and doing investigative work. So that came together in my early to mid-20s, and even at a young age, I was passionate separately about photography and about animals and hadn't clued in that I could put the two together. I always had a great empathy for animals, and even at a young age was trying to rescue them. And as soon as I could volunteer at the Humane Society, I was doing that, walking dogs and things like that. And that's something that I also want to nurture in other people. I think that kids have an innate compassion, and I certainly did. I think it's maybe, in a way, bred out of us as we get older, and we become immune to all the things that we see, and eventually we don't see them. So, you know, with my camera, I'm trying to illuminate these things again, and also when kids are seeing my pictures, I want them to, I want the pictures that they see from We Animals to, you know, ignite their compassion and their empathy for animals and help that grow.
Mm-hmm. Let's. I'll talk about the education aspect a bit more later. But first, I just wonder if we can kind of paint a picture for our listeners about what types of issues your photos cover.
You know, as I said, it started close to home, and then you know, meat markets and animals in zoos and used for pets and entertainment. But then it grew, and I spent some time in Africa working with chimpanzees and documenting bushmeat issues. And I've been to Southeast Asia a few times now to work with the Animals Asia Foundation and to document variable farming. And, you know, wherever I go, unfortunately, there's this stuff that needs documenting. So because of that, the We Animals Project is quite big now. Oh, but I never answered unique stories about We Animals, but there are so many. Maybe we just get back to that later.
Yeah, sure. Or you can share now just a couple highlights.
Well, there have been a lot of powerful and meaningful moments for me throughout the last decade. I've met so many individuals. I've met hundreds of thousands of individuals, actually, in factory farms. And then, you know, sometimes it's a single animal, like a pig in a gestation crate, or a specific bear who's been rescued and now is living a happy life at a sanctuary. I definitely carry these animals with me, these specific animals with me in my heart, and think of them often, and they inspire me. They inspire me to keep working. For example, this one pig that I will never forget, and she just was so forlorn, as most of them are in these places, but her face sticks with me, and she inspires me to work harder all the time. And there's a chimpanzee named Ron who spent his life, he spent decades in biomedical research and was rescued by a really amazing group called Save the Chimps. And he's also very dear to me, and I can't say that there's any particular reason other than that, you know, he was a beautiful man. He was a beautiful individual, and generous with the other chimps. And he was a pacifist, and he really moved me. So, you know, it's hard to think of these groups of animals as a whole and feel compassion and empathy. Like, but you know, when I think of Ron, that one chimp or that one pig, it brings the focus back to helping the individuals, and that inspires me. And I know that it also inspires lots of other people. For example, it's hard to feel compassion for 1 billion chickens in such and such country. Like, it's a number we can't comprehend. But if we can think about one particular chicken, and that's what my work does, right? It illuminates the individuals. So if we can feel, you know, feel for this one particular chicken, then that helps us feel for all the rest.
Well, I noticed that in your work, you can definitely get a sense of the personality of that one animal. And I think that's why your work is just so powerful and has such an impact.
Farm Sanctuary, they have a project right now called Someone, Not Something. Mm. And they use my photos for that. And I think it's really powerful because they're about illuminating individuals. And people are, you know, really excited about that, and I'd like to continue that project with the farm. So, you know, maybe there's some talks in the works with them about how I can be involved and keep promoting this idea.
Yeah. Let's talk now about other ways that your photos are getting out there and making an impact. I know that there's a film in the works. If you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, there's a film called The Ghosts in Our Machine, and there's a lot of hype about it right now, which is really great. It is a film that looks at our relationships with animals, as does the We Animals Project. I'm the central human character in this film, and it follows me as I do investigative work and as I tell stories. So we're looking at animals and entertainment. We're looking at animals used for fur, animals used for food, and animals used in labs. And we can't always get access to, you know, places like labs, but what we can do is tell the stories of the people and the animals involved after the fact. For example, we're telling the story of two beagles named Maggie and Abby, and they were rescued from a lab. And that's, you know, a really great positive way of telling their story, and hopefully a lot of people will want to go out and adopt, you know, adopt more animals after that as well. So, yeah, it's a pretty exciting movie, and I'm really happy to be part of it.
filming has wrapped up, I think. Do you know when people can expect to see it?
Well, fingers crossed that we have the premiere at Sundance, but you never know. I mean, they may not accept it, or they may. We'll see. And hopefully at Hot Docs in Toronto, so that would be the spring. So I imagine that people will be able to see it in theaters and eventually get DVDs, by spring 2013 and definitely by the end of 2013. I'd love to tour with the film if possible and get it out there far and wide.
We at Animal Voices will look forward to speaking with the director when it's closer to the release, for sure.
Great,
so.
Yeah.
We'll keep our listeners up to date about that. And other ways that We Animals is evolving and getting out there. I saw that you have also some videos on your website. So you've been playing with sound and video. And do you plan to do more documentaries of your own? Or
There's so much on the table right now. I can't really keep up. But I am trying to expand the multimedia aspect of it. I work quite a bit with my partner, Carl Orzechowski, and he does film and video and sound as well. So more and more we're doing things together and collaborating, and he's great with putting this stuff together, and I have no skills for that. So, so we're expanding that way, and we have about two or three videos that are sort of in progress right now. And what else? Well, there's just a long list of organizations and campaigns, and there's always a request coming in for images. And anyone who's using the images to help animals can use them for free. So they're getting out that way. And I'm trying to get the images out more into the mainstream, but it's a bit more difficult because animals... The issue of animals is very, very personal, as I've learned to people. And it's so interesting to see when I go to like a mainstream news outlet or magazine and I say, hey, here's the We Animals Project. The editors, usually the first thing they say is like they actually sit back in their chair and rub their eyes and say, oh, I eat meat, or they need to talk about their experiences with animals right away. And so it's very personal for everyone. And they often have to get their head around how they feel about animals before they can even think about running my work, you know, in their mainstream media. So it's been a bit of a challenge. Editors in the mainstream want to focus more on positive stories and not so much the harder stuff that's part of We Animals. So it's a challenge, but I'm working on it.
Good, good. And I read in your blog somewhere, I think you're working on writing a book. Is that another avenue?
Yeah, it's another avenue, it's another way of getting We Animals out there. I certainly wouldn't say that it's the surefire way of getting the message out, you know, as far as it can go, but there are, you know, strategically there are a lot of good reasons for putting a book out there, and I do have 10 years worth of you know, photos and stories under my belt, And so, that's one other venue. And it'll be a photo-driven book with some essays. And I have some other book ideas as well that illuminate work of activists around the globe. But that's that'll be down the road.
Yeah, awesome. Now, let's talk now about the humane education program that you're sort of launching on a wider scale. Tell us about that and the goals of the program.
Sure. Well, this is one of my favorite parts of We Animals, actually. In an effort to get these stories seen and heard and felt, I'm now going to schools and communities and libraries and all this, and I've launched the We Animals Humane Education Program. So these are different programs for different age groups that get people excited about animals, and generally the title of the programs is Widening Our Circle of Compassion. And, you know, just getting kids to consider animals in a different way that they do. You know, people generally like animals, but overlook the fact that, you know, we also use and abuse them for clothing and entertainment and food. So bringing these stories to youth in a really positive way and a really eye-opening and empowering way. and you know, planting seeds for change with these kids, you know, hopefully, as they become leaders and as they become adults and educators as well, they will also pass along a message of compassion. I think there is an innate compassion in children for animals, and that's just, you know, as we grow up, we lose that. And so it's really important to nurture that through humane education with kids. That's something that's never really been in schools, maybe, you know, a little bit here and there through, you know, sociology classes and stuff. But humane education is, as far as I'm concerned, a pioneering thing right now, and there's going to be more and more of it in schools. And not just for animals, you know, for humans. And what I'm seeing in schools now is that there's more of a focus on sociological change and getting kids to volunteer and getting them involved in community. And so this is one aspect of that. A lot of programs for kids are focusing on helping humans, and not so many are for, you know, helping animals and widening our circle of compassion for animals. So that's where I see this humane education program fitting in. And there's really, really great response so far. I'm so thrilled. There's requests for these talks all over the place, be it at veg fairs or at schools, libraries, church groups. It's really exciting.
Yeah, I wish you best of luck with that program. I think it's a great idea. I was wondering if you can share some advice for people who want to use their own creative skills to help animals.
Oh, that's my favorite topic. And there's a new photo gallery on We Animals looking specifically at that, and it's called Words into Actions. And over the last 10 years, I've photographed people doing whatever they can, whether it's letter writing or protesting or, you know, taking direct action. There's just so many ways to get out there and speak your mind and show that you care. So there's a new gallery on We Animals about that, and that's also how I end all of the humane education programs, because some of it can be a bit heavy, but then, you know, to end with, well, this is what you can do, and this is what other people are doing. So with kids especially, that can be really interactive. We can ask all of them, you know, what do you like to do? What do you like to do? What do you love? What are you good at? And anything that they answer can be applied to helping not just animals, but community and the elderly and any, you know, anyone who needs help. We all can do something. And then getting that dialogue going with kids is really, really exciting, because you see them just light up. And because sometimes they look at this work, or, you know, they might react by saying, well, I'm not a photographer, and I'm only 9. I can't travel the world, so what can I do? So then when we bring it back to them as, and it should always go that way, it's just so exciting.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. It sounds really, really exciting. And yeah, I wish you the best of luck with this program again. And I think those are great words of wisdom. So thanks for your time, Joanne, and for all that you do for animals. Can you just tell our listeners how to learn more about the programs that you're involved in?
Yeah, sure. The We Animals Project and the We Animals Archive is at the site weanimals.org. And the Humane Education is humaneeducation.ca. And even though it's a .ca, so Canada, I'm doing these talks in the U.S. and elsewhere as well.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. And there's also The Ghost in Our Machine, which is the upcoming documentary about animals, which is so exciting. And that is The Ghost in our machine.com.
Excellent. So we'll post links for that on our website, and hopefully people will check them out. And thanks again for your time, Joanne.
Great. Okay, talk to you again.
Yep. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, the Animal Voices Show. We are soon to be 100.5 FM, starting next week. On next week's show, we'll have Martin Guinness on the show, who is the director of the recently released and award-winning documentary called Cages of Shame. And he'll be speaking about the film and the bear bile industry. This is something that has really interested me for some time, and I really look forward to seeing this film. Don't forget to come to our Animal Voices and Raw BC Vegan Potluck happening this Sunday, September 9th. It starts at 5:30 p.m. at Trout Lake Park at the covered picnic area on the south end of the lake near the concession and playground. And if you like what you are hearing, we invite you to support Animal Voices, the Animal Voices show. We are part of Vancouver Cooperative Radio, and we need listener support to stay on the air. Please go to cooperadio.org to make a donation in the name of Animal Voices. We'd really appreciate that. We're on Twitter, Animal Voices YVR. You can find us on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver. Please check out our website, animalvoices.org. You can download all of our past shows there as podcasts, and they're also available on iTunes. And if you want to send us an email and let us know what you think of the show or any suggestions or ideas, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So I'm going to leave you with a song. I think it's fitting. It's called The Littlest Birds, and Alyssa, maybe you chose this because it sounded like there was a little bird in the background of that interview.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I didn't think of that. But
well, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's why she chose it. It's by the Be Good Tanyas. Thanks for listening. Take care and remember to be kind to the animals.
Well, I feel like an old hobo on sad, lonesome and blue. I was fair as a summer day. Now the summer days are through. You pass through places and places pass through you, but you carry them with you on the soles of your traveler shoes.